Hi, it's Tom here. We've got a great episode of Last Orders coming up for you today. But before we do that, I just want to let you know two ways that you can support this show. First off, please do give us a positive rating and review with your podcast provider. It takes 30 seconds, it costs you nothing, and it's a great way to help us reach new people. Second, if you can afford it, please do consider making a donation to Spiked, ideally in the form of a regular donation. Last Orders, like all of Spiked's content, is free for all. So we rely on the generosity of our readers and our listeners to keep us going and growing. Even £5 a month is a huge help. So if you haven't already, do take a second to give us a rating and a review. And if you don't donate to us, but you'd like to, please do sign up today. Just go to spiked-online.com and click on that big red donate button in the top right corner to do so. Thanks so much. And now on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, a Spiked podcast. This is a show all about freedom, the nanny state and censorship. But these days, we spend a lot of our time talking about COVID. Today, we discuss lockdown 2.0, Scotland's war on free speech and the prospects for a Brexit deal. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, Deputy Editor of Spiked, and today I'm joined, as ever, by Chris Snowden, Director of Lifestyle Economics at the Institute of Economic Affairs. How are you doing, Chris?
Could be worse, Tom.
And today we're delighted to be joined by Daniel Hannan. Dan is a columnist. He was a Conservative MEP from 1999 to 2020, and he's the President of the Initiative for Free Trade. Dan, thanks so much for joining us on the show today.
Great to be here. Thanks, Tom.
So we're going to talk in large part about lockdown 2.0. It wasn't that long ago that Boris Johnson was referring to a second national lockdown as the nuclear option. And in the past week, he's just gone and pressed that big red button. So we're back to where we were in April, it feels like, at least in terms of restrictions, a 4-week lockdown, though many people assume it's going to be longer than that. It seems like the government were harried into this by some pretty scary projections of as many as 4,000 deaths per day by early December. And again, the message for the foreseeable future is again back to stay at home, protect the NHS and save lives. It feels pretty bleak going into all of this. So, Chris, to kick things off, I'm not going to ask if you're for this measure because I know that you're not. But what do you make of the government's arguments for it with the figures that they put front and centre on Saturday and the case that they're making for going into this all over again?
Well, they're fraudulent, really, as far as I can see. There's not much else you can say about it because they've published so little to date, at least. Maybe perhaps more will come out in the next few days. But, you know, the record shows, if anybody listens back to these podcasts this year, they'll see that myself and the guests we've had on, generally speaking, were basically pro-lockdown in March. We understood the NHS possibly was going to go into a kind of Northern Italy situation. And it was only because it was prolonged well beyond the point at which it should have been. It should never have carried on in May and June. I said that at the time, and I think that even more now. But this time, we don't even know how close we are to the NHS collapsing because the government is incredibly cagey about the hospital capacity, even in places like Liverpool and Manchester, where you've got the highest number of cases. And that immediately makes me suspicious that actually these hospitals are not going to be overwhelmed as quickly as they say. And then when Boris turns up eventually on Saturday night on television with his disco stew charts and witty in balance as his henchman once again, you can just see that these are not realistic projections. And saying that 4,000 people are going to be dying every day within about a month is just not credible by any standards. And then recently, Neil Ferguson pops up. He can't resist, you know, chiming in, Neil Ferguson. You really would think somebody like him would be better just lying low at this stage.
As the dog returneth to his vomit, so the fool returneth to his vomit.
Yeah, him and John Edmonds in particular, you know, couldn't have discredited themselves more, but they can't resist going back on TV. So Neil Ferguson then comes back to defend the worst of the dodgy models. And he says, well, this is a model from 3 weeks ago, and we're assuming the R number is about 1.3 to 1.5. And that tier three restrictions, in fact, the tier system in general, won't really have much of an impact. And if you assume that, then this is how the deaths and the cases look. Well, we know that, firstly, the R was lower than that when Boris made his announcement. We are pretty sure that the tier system has an effect. I mean, it would be remarkable if tier three didn't have an effect, if you believe lockdown has an effect, because tier three is only really a stone's throw away from being a full lockdown. Moreover, we can see in the daily data that the cases have been falling quite a lot in places like Liverpool, have been falling throughout. In fact, the entire Northwest certainly have been falling dramatically in places like Nottingham, which only went into tier three last week. So the basic assumption that things cannot be turned around without lockdown is wrong. Now, it may be that cases are not falling fast enough and that hospitals are 99% full and we need to take drastic action in some areas. Perhaps, well, we don't know because they won't give us the data, but that certainly is a theoretical possibility, in which case it seems to me that you don't need to lock down Cornwall in order to deal with that. You don't need a national lockdown. But it seems that Sage, Whitty, Valence are all intent and have been for some time intent on bringing us back into a full lockdown. I don't know whether the government have been accomplices in this or dupes, but either way, the whole thing stinks.
And Dan, what's your take on lockdown 2.0? Do you think it's justified?
Yeah, so I think there's two big differences between March and now. The one argument for lockdown, the one strong argument that there always was to buy time. To buy time, extend capacity, you know, build your Nightingale hospitals, buy in your PPE or your ventilators or whatever, see if you've got a better way of palliating or treating the condition. Fine. And as Chris said, that argument had already expired by April or by the end of April. But no one can make that argument about what looks like an endemic virus. And it seems to me the only possible justification for a new lockdown would be if you have good reason to believe that you are very close to a mass vaccination rollout. Right? In that situation, you'd be buying time for something. But given that a lockdown pushes deaths down the road rather than reducing them, you've otherwise got to ask the question, what are you buying time for? I think the other thing that has changed since March, and it's very, very striking, is the polarization of the debate as represented in these podcasts, among other things, right? So in March, by and large, the pro-lockdown case was buy time. The anti-lockdown case was this is disproportionate. But both of those positions were susceptible to further evidence, right? They were arguments of detail, not of principle. And what's happened since then has been that because, just like with Brexit or just like with the Scottish referendum, because the same story has been leading the news day after day after day, it's human nature that people start defining themselves, at least in part, by where they stand on that issue. And once people start doing that, it's almost a law of nature that they start taking up harder and harder positions. So the pro-lockdown case has evolved from buy time, build capacity, into keep everything closed until a vaccine comes along. And the anti-lockdown case has gone from this is disproportionate and the cost-benefit analysis doesn't stack up, into there is no second wave, the whole thing's a hoax, it's not a dangerous thing anyway, it's all a plot got up by Bill Gates or Big Pharma. And once that happens, you get a culture war situation where you're not so much arguing against a position defined by data that might evolve, you're arguing against a person that you imagine that you don't like. And that's when it starts getting nasty. So I suppose, make this mild plea for mitigation on behalf of the decision makers that in a climate like that, almost whatever you do is going to be incredibly unpopular, right? You're in a media and political climate where nobody wants to understand the concept of lesser evil. No one wants to give you any benefit of the doubt. So it often happens in politics that you have to choose between bad alternatives. You do A, bad things will happen. You do B, bad things will happen. But you know now that whichever of those you take, a huge chunk of the media will jump on the bad things and say, oh, you see, this just shows that you should have done the opposite. And so I would just make this mild defense of the decision makers, the ministers and their advisors, that almost anything they do is going to be howled down by a large chunk of the electorate.
And Chris, if you want to respond to any of that, please do. But I just wanted to ask you about Dan's first point, which is what this is for. What is the strategy here? What are we buying time to do? Because whilst it did seem at first that, again, lockdown was all about protecting the NHS from being overwhelmed, that justification does seem to have gone out of the window. A lot of people fear, I think, that we are moving into just a kind of cycle of these lockdowns. This will just be a means through which that we manage the outbreak until, as Matt Hancock sees it, the cavalry arrives in some way, shape or form, whether it be a vaccine or mass testing or whatever. What do you think the government's plan is here? at this point.
Oh, it hasn't got one, other than the vague thing that people say all the time about, oh, we need a functioning test and trace system. I'm sick to death of hearing about the functioning test and trace system. I've become increasingly skeptical about whether it'll ever work in this country, because people aren't going to isolate themselves for 14 days a lot of the time.
They do seem to be moving towards cheaper instant tests, right? A test that give you an immediate readout, like a pregnancy test. If that became cheap and widely available, then presumably people wouldn't need to isolate for 2 weeks. They just need to test themselves. And that would be a much more feasible operation.
Only if it worked with people who were asymptomatic from the get-go. I'm not sure if that's the case. Right. I don't think that's the case with the existing tests. And so people would still have to isolate for a good few days. I mean, in Sweden, the system is you isolate for 7 days and you don't catch everybody, but you catch most people like that. The benefit of doing it is you provide a realistic possibility that most people are going to do it. 14 days to a lot of people, particularly since it's only quite recently that people have been given reasonable compensation for doing it. It's just never going to work. I mean, I'm just very skeptical about test and trace as being this great panacea. But people like Independent Sage always say, well, we need to lock down and we need to buy ourselves a few more weeks and get test and trace sorted out. Well, they've been saying this for months. We've had months, obviously, and we haven't sorted test and trace out. Even the original projections only said it would reduce the R a little bit. This is not something that you're going to keep the disease totally suppressed with. So what are we buying time for? We're not buying time for anything other than a vaccine, which, of course, that still hasn't come close to being approved. Yeah, we are going to see a cycle of these. I think we're bound to see one in January. I've always thought we'd have one in January because I just assume that what always happens around Christmas is people travel around, see their elderly relatives, spread the flu normally, of course, every year, but that's why you have a flu season in January, February primarily, is because people are mixing in Christmas time. So I'm convinced that we'll have a significant lockdown probably starting around about the end of January, if you want me to make a prediction, and that will go on for ages and potentially will go on till there is a vaccine, because by January, February, it might be that the vaccine's been approved. It's just we need to roll it out. But the economic damage that this will do, I mean, it's impossible to overstate the economic damage this will do. And coming back to Dan's point about, you know, it's just picking the lesser of two evils. Well, I think in this instance, given that the tiered system didn't really have time to prove itself and that rates were falling in a lot of hotspots way before the lockdown was announced, I think the government has chosen guaranteed economic catastrophe a possible overwhelming of the
Agents. I think they've made the wrong decision. We need to understand, though, the media and public opinion context, right? There's a sort of déformation professionnelle, the French call it, a tendency to be pushed by the job you do into a particular position, almost regardless of your own views. Suppose, for the sake of argument, that we had taken a sort of Swedish line, or we'd stuck to a Swedish line in mid-March. And we'd said, you know, protect a few of the more vulnerable people and ban some big meetings and wash your hands and be sensible, but basically try and keep things open. And suppose for the sake of argument that that had been completely vindicated, that our overall infection and fatality rates had been in line with countries that had gone for a full lockdown. Does anyone imagine that with our media rather than Sweden's media, with Piers Morgan every day saying another granny murdered by Boris Johnson, with the papers taking the position they then did, and the public, frankly, taking the position that they then did, that would have been a sustainable political position? You see, I mean, I wish it were as easy as being able to say, this is all the fault of Sage, or this is all the fault of ministers, or whatever. But the truth is that right from the beginning, there has been a massive majority in the country at large in favor of the most authoritarian and illiberal measures. And that's something we've just got to confront.
That is true. I mean, I would say this only probably partially explains it, but the government did go out of its way to terrify people for weeks on end around the time
Fair point.
That happened. And in Sweden, I gather the Swedish press actually had been pushing for a lockdown, and quite a significant minority of the public wanted a lockdown, possibly even a majority. It just didn't happen there for one reason or another. But no, you're right. I mean, we are in a minority, those of us who are against this lockdown. And there are a lot of reasons for why people are in favor of it, but a significant section of the public quite enjoy it.
By the way, it's really important, I think, to stress the point that Chris makes about Sweden, and not just now, but that he's made in the past. Because as soon as you say Sweden, you get the automatic double barrel of higher deaths and higher economic hit, which the second of which is bullshit. But the first one is utterly irrelevant because the pro-Sweden argument, if you want to call it that, as enunciated by Chris and by me and by others, is not that Sweden has done everything right or that it's a perfect role model or that we should copy it. It's that Sweden invalidates the case on which all the lockdowns were originally based, because we were told in March the lockdown is the only alternative to a kind of extinction level event. If we don't lock down, there will be hundreds of thousands of preventable deaths. So Sweden showed that that was untrue. And the fact that there may have been a lower death rate in Finland or whatever is utterly, utterly irrelevant. And by the way, it's not only Sweden. There is a regional Sweden in every part of the world, right? If you take Sweden as the control of the European experiment, the place that they didn't lock down, you know, there's various US states. There's the Dakotas and so on. There are the Swedens of the US. There's Brazil, there's Belarus, there's, you know, Tanzania. There are enough comparable places around the world which didn't go for a full lockdown to show that the premise on which the original lockdowns was based was false.
And the models were false as well. Yeah. And that's the other thing. I'm kind of getting kind of sick of smart-assed upper normies talking about exponential growth as if that's all you need to know. You know, the epidemic is either doubling or halving, as Chris Whitty said the other day. I mean, it's trivially true, but it doesn't get you anywhere.
Yeah. You know, there is not a single country where it has carried on going exponential.
Well, that's the point, right?
Including places. I mean, it's not just the Swedens and the Belaruses that chose not to have a lockdown. There are large parts of the planet where the government was in no position to impose quarantine on teeming slum populations. And in all of those places as well, it rose and then peaked and then fell.
I take your point entirely, Dan. Lockdown skeptics are certainly in the minority, and as you made the point in the Telegraph recently, we have seemed to have lost the argument, certainly with the government, but arguably with public opinion as well. But things do seem to be changing on one level. I think it's fair to say that even in the media sphere, there's a lot more criticism than there was before. The tabloids are certainly giving the government a hard time over the question of lockdown. You look at the opinion polls, people are concerned about the economy over public health. That gap seems to be closing pretty quickly. I mean, Chris, just to put this question to you, do you think, particularly as the economic impacts of all of this is really going to start to bite over the next couple of months, are we going to start to see the political dial shift here, I guess, as public opinion starts to become less lockdown fanatical as it has seemed so far?
I don't know if you can build a majority against it when you look at all the people who are for it and the reasons that they have for being for it. So this is generalizing somewhat, but it's reasonable to expect most pensioners to be broadly in favor of it, right? We all lose a certain amount of social life, obviously, but they have a pension and they're not losing any money from this. Similarly, I guess a lot of people on disability living allowance, similarly, a lot of people in the public sector, a lot of people like myself who work from home most of the time anyway, a lot of people who don't normally work from home, but rather like doing it. There's a big, you know, coalition of people who they're not really suffering as a result of lockdown in the same way that a lot of people who tend not to have a voice in the media are suffering. So I'm not very sure that we'll, even when people see the economic consequences laid bare, and a lot of them, by the way, we won't even see them until after the whole thing's passed, probably, with the furlough scheme going on and on and on. But even as the economic damage becomes more and more apparent, I still think there'll be a majority of people who don't personally think they have enough to lose.
And Dan, on the question of this being a political problem for Boris Johnson, just internally, I mean, we're recording this on Tuesday. Parliament is going to vote on these measures on Wednesday. It's, you know, guaranteed to go through, but with a pretty sizable Tory rebellion. We've also seen in the past week Nigel Farage be resurrected, the Brexit Party being rebranded as the Reform Party, taking up the Great Barrington Declaration, the focused protection approach to coronavirus. Do you think this could be a potential political headache for Boris Johnson? Not because there's going to be a huge kind of popular uprising necessarily against these measures, but because there's going to be more political pressure from those two sources, at least.
It's a good question. I'm not sure there will be that sizable a revolt. I think that you will get a slightly misreading figure, if you like, from Parliament, in that there'll be an overwhelming vote, which will not reflect quite a lot of the unease of the people who ended up on balance voting for the lockdown. I do think there are some signs that the complete consensus in favor of whatever the most authoritarian proposition you can put in front of people was, that is beginning to break down. I mean, up until now, the polls have been pitilessly inflexible, and it kind of almost doesn't matter how you phrase the question, right? People will always say that they want maximum closures and close the pubs, close the borders, close the schools, close the shops, you know, impose a curfew. And frankly, there is an authoritarian streak in this, as in every other country,
even in normal times. And I suspect that quite a few of the people who think there should be a curfew always think that there should be a curfew, you know, even if there was no virus, you know, oh, young people these days. And I had one like that on the radio the other day. We should have the military for as long as it takes. And I was speaking after him and I knew who was going to carry the majority of the listeners, right? It wasn't going to be me. But having said that, you do develop a slight sense in your line of work or mine for when the ice is starting to crack before the poles have actually moved. And yeah, there were straws in the wind. There was the enormously warm response to Maureen from Barnsley. It was interesting that if you watch the whole clip, she was one of four. The other three were all more or less pro-lockdown, but nobody remembers what they said because there's a kind of perfunctory wooden aspect now to the pro-lockdown case, whereas everyone remembers her. The passion has moved to one side. As you say, Nigel Farage has switched his position. He was strongly authoritarian at the beginning. He, I think, is also reading public opinion. You've got newspapers, particularly a couple of the tabloids, that have performed 180-degree turns on this. So up until this weekend, I thought, funnily enough, Boris is actually going to end up in quite a good position here because Starmer has jumped on this lockdown bandwagon and ended the bipartisan approach just at the moment when public opinion is about to turn. And at some point in November, you'll see the polls beginning to move. Now, of course, all that's in the air again, because when everybody is pro-lockdown and when the PM, who had previously been trying to take a kind of middle way, has shifted his view, there isn't really much for the lockdown skeptics to hang their doubts on. There isn't an obvious peg. So I'm less optimistic now than I was, and I'm afraid I rather agree with Chris. I just think any easing of this lockdown is going to be carried out in the teeth of public opposition.
But there will be a lot of resistance. I mean, I should make that clear. I think there may be riots at some point, actually, maybe not this month, but in the next 2 or 3 months, wouldn't surprise me. There'll certainly be a lot of flouting the rules by younger people, and I don't really blame them. I don't think that the people of this country can be controlled to this extent for this long in the middle of winter.
People, as far as I can tell, I had dinner with a bunch of students, one of whom had just got out of isolation. You know, they're in bubbles, in households, they're called. And someone in his group had tested positive. He immediately said to the other sort of 10 members of the household, let's make sure we spend lots of time with such and such. We do not want to have to isolate again. We've got to make sure we get this thing now. And he said initially, all of the others were incredibly resistant to this argument. He said, but after 24 hours in quarantine, they all came around to my point of view. Wow. Right. So the students in a lot of places, perfectly rationally in a sense, they do not want to test positive on the last day of term. Right. So there's a sort of perverse incentive for them to get it now. I just wonder, thinking about that, whether we shouldn't just acknowledge it, whether we shouldn't go with the flow, especially where you have campuses that are relatively contained, not whether the whole student population is kind of dispersed through a city, but where you can do it, where you've got a campus that has a place to eat and a bar and so on, whether instead of having bubbles and trying to slow the thing down, you shouldn't say, actually, just pull all the vulnerable people out and encourage all the students to carry on normally, right? And then allow the vulnerable people to come back when everyone has already had it. Obviously, you know, Chris and I would like to go further and not have a lockdown, but it seems to me that the one winnable argument here is, shouldn't we take the most obviously self-contained and low-risk population and allow them to develop some immunity now?
Yeah, like the Great Barrington, but in miniature.
Yeah.
Last Orders, like all of Spike's podcasts, is free. There are no subscriptions, bonus episodes for paying customers. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to help us do so, we rely on the generosity of our listeners. So if you enjoy the show and have a bit of money to spare, please do consider making a donation. Anything you can give is greatly appreciated. Now, back to the show. Let's move on and talk about another fundamental liberty that seems to be under threat, particularly north of the border, and that's freedom of speech. So the Scottish Hate Crime Bill is back in the news. This was after the Scottish Justice Secretary Humza Yousaf said that even conversations over the dinner table that incite hatred must be prosecuted under this new hate crime law. So this hate crime bill, many listeners would have heard about it. It would expand hate speech restrictions in Scotland. It sparked alarm for its potential prohibition, not just on hateful remarks, but hateful plays even, potentially, and even possessing inflammatory material. So again, it seems like another assault on freedom of speech, particularly in Scotland. Chris, what's your response to all this? And particularly, why does it feel like the SNP has such a propensity for being so
uniquely authoritarian.
I don't know. I guess because they can get away with it, right? I mean, I don't claim to be an expert on Scottish politics, but assuming there isn't a referendum on Scottish independence, let's say, over the next 10 years, I mean, is it just going to be a one-party state until they get independence? I mean, what do you do? If you don't like Nicola Sturgeon, but you want independence, who are you supposed to vote for in Scotland? You know, it just seems they're just stuck with, in my opinion, a really awful government who come up with basically fascist policies like this hate crime thing, which I thought would be watered down by now, but it doesn't seem to be at all. It seems to, if anything, got worse. And also, just incidentally, going back to the previous topic, how come it's all right for Nicola Sturgeon to have regional approaches to COVID? No one's calling on Nicola Sturgeon to bring a national lockdown. Apparently, it's perfectly reasonable when you've got different rates of infection around Scotland to have local lockdowns.
Really good point.
I mean, she gets away with murder.
Well, not on that occasion. She gets away with non-murder. I mean, she's getting away with doing the right thing there, right? I mean, we should acknowledge that.
Well, true. Yes, indeed. But she gets away playing by different rules than everybody else seems to. You know, the whole hate crime is nonsense. Am I misremembering this? But didn't hate crime originally used to involve an actual crime plus a sort of unpleasant motive? So if you beat somebody up, that was a crime and you'd be punished for it anyway. But if you had some racist or homophobic intention, your sentence would be even stronger. And now a hate crime is just the second part of that. It's just having some unpleasant view and expressing it. There's been, over quite a short period of time, this transition between genuine crimes that harm people, but with this element of hatred behind it, and just saying things that Nicola Sturgeon doesn't like.
Not only, as you say, Chris, has there been this slippage from hate crime being a physical crime with hateful motive to it just being speech, but also we now have this phenomenon of non-crime hate incidents. So where you don't even break the law, but this is a matter for the police, as we saw in that famous Harry Miller case from a couple of years ago. But just turn to you, Dan, what's your response to this new hate crime bill? Has it concerned you as you've been reading about this?
I run out of vocabulary adequately to express what I think about the enormity of criminalizing private opinion in a private dwelling. So I will instead quote Pitt the Elder on the subject. "The poorest man may in his cottage bid defiance to all the forces of the crown. It may be frail. The rain may come in, the wind may enter, the storm may enter, but the King of England may not enter." He was, of course, also the King of Scotland by the time Pitt the Elder said that in the 1780s, right? There is an extraordinary shift here in what we understood to be the proper bounds of private and public spheres, right? Even if you are generally a believer in kind of policing standards and saying that some things oughtn't to be said, it used to be the case that, you know, if you like, a passerby might inadvertently overhear those things and be assaulted by the sensation. The idea that we're now just persecuting people because of what they say privately, because of what they think privately. I mean, this is, you know, this is O'Brien in the final pages of 1984. I'm going to get inside your head and cure you. I'm going to convert you because I can't stand the idea of somebody holding an opinion that dissents from the official party line. And that is a truly terrifying thing. Especially something like that to be happening in the homeland of David Hume and Adam Smith. There are many, many wonderful things that my mother's country gave to the world. But the one that is the most enduring of Scotland's contributions to the human race is the Enlightenment. The idea that you have freedom and you use that freedom to have debate and to trial and test new ideas and argue and test things empirically and not just take things, as it were, with the authority of a bayonet behind them. And it's a really tragic thing that a government in Scotland, of all places, can do something this illiberal and remain, you know, at 56% in the polls or whatever it is. I think that's a really sad comment on where we are.
And Chris, is there also a bit of a danger here about us in England being a little bit complacent, because there's been a lot of concern about this particular bill, a lot of criticism rightfully served the SNP for not only this but other very illiberal policies it's implemented around free speech over the years. But you know, we are in the wake, what was it, only about a month ago, where we had the Metropolitan Police interviewing Darren Grimes for the crime of potentially stirring up hatred for things that someone he interviewed, namely David Starkey, had said. So isn't, in a sense, what so shocks us about this hate crime bill just reminds us that we have these hate speech laws in the first place, and while they might not go as far as Nicola Sturgeon is, they still go pretty far in the first place.
Absolutely, yeah, we can't rest on our laurels in this country. Police have got a bit of a thing about Darren, but hopefully they might leave him alone from now on. I don't know.
Apparently the reason they went after him rather than David Starkey, says David Starkey, is that they couldn't find David Starkey's email or address. I mean, that's the level of policing.
Was it not that Darren was the publisher of it? I assumed it was because it was Darren's show. He put it out there.
According to a piece that Starkey wrote a couple of weeks ago, they couldn't find him, which is, by the way, you know, I mean, any intern can tell you David Starkey's address. He's not somebody who, you know, hides from publicity. I think there was a Canadian blogger who I thought just came up with the most brilliant rebuttal of this whole kind of woke tyranny when she phrased it as, "You're too stupid to tell me what to think." And I honestly haven't come up with a better way of formulating the problem with hate crimes thinking.
Yeah, absolutely agree.
So we're fast approaching the end of our time, but Dan, I think we'd be remiss, given you were such a leading figure in the Brexit campaign, if we didn't ask you what was going on with the negotiations, what's going on with Brexit, where you see things sitting. So we've been hearing a similar message, it feels like, for the past couple of weeks. You know, a deal can be done, but there's still work to do. Things have gone quite quiet recently, which is usually a sign, it seems, that a deal was in the offing. But what's your take on negotiations at this point? Do you think we're likely to get a deal, and will it be a good one if we do?
Yeah, my sense is that we will get a deal, and it will be a much less good deal than if we hadn't had the whole nonsense of Theresa May agreeing the sequencing and agreeing the withdrawal agreement and the Irish protocol and so on. But it would still be an improvement on remaining in the EU. However, all of this has been overtaken by events. I mean, if you take the most optimistic economic forecasts of the most cheerful Brexiteer and you compare them to the glummest and most miserable fears of the most angst-ridden Ramona, the distance between those two positions now looks trivial compared to what we're spending every day on the coronavirus lockdowns, the furlough scheme, the quantitative easing and all the rest of it. So all of that, if you like, suddenly looks irrelevant. And it's interesting only in that the people who got so terribly exercised about a forecast that would show that our GDP might be a quarter of 1% smaller or something, and other ones very often saying, lock everything down, throw away the key, doesn't matter, don't you care about, you know. So we're not going to be able to take a short or even medium-term view, really, of the economics of Brexit, because all of that has been overtaken by coronavirus and particularly the negative effects on countries like this one that went further with the lockdown. I think, though, that in the long term, if you think of this as a kind of gradual process of secular reorientation away from a relatively small market towards what I regard as our natural hinterland across the oceans, that will turn out to be vindicated. And I think that even by this time next year, we will probably be in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We will have new trade deals with a number of English-speaking common law countries across the oceans. And yes, we'll still have a deal with the EU. And I think that we will see the beginning of what will eventually turn into a return for us of our traditional global position as the world exponent and exemplar of free trade.
Chris, what's your thought on all this? And do you share Dan's feeling that, you know, a lot of the arguments we had previously are a bit academic, given everything else that's going on at the moment, particularly in relation to the economy?
Oh, yeah. I mean, even a no-deal Brexit pales into insignificance. You know, a no-deal Brexit is not something I in any way welcomed. I think it would be fairly catastrophic on its own terms. But, oh, God, things are just so awful that, you know, none of it, I don't care, really, anymore. We've kind of got it done. We're not going to be rejoining the EU, so let's see what happens. I mean, we're going to have to kick on, aren't we? We're going to get a deal, though, Dan. I mean, people need to know what's going to happen on the 1st of January.
Well, not only that, it needs to be ratified.
Yeah.
So we will need to know within a couple of weeks. If by Remembrance Sunday we have heard nothing, that would be a bad sign. But I think that by then it will be clear what the outline is.
And Dan, just finally, we're recording this the day of the US election. It's going to come out a couple of days later, which is why we haven't really touched on that at all whatsoever. We don't really know what the result's going to be. But at the same time, there's been a lot of talk about whether a Trump or a Biden presidency would be good for Brexit Britain. A lot of discussion about Joe Biden really taking the view that Boris Johnson is, in Trump's words, Brexit Trump, that he'll be more focused on a reset with the European Union. And that if, again, we're talking about trying to get a trade agreement with the US at some sort of point, that could be quite bad for us. Do you share that view that a Biden presidency could potentially be a problem for Britain and for Boris Johnson?
Yes, it could. I mean, obviously, I may look an idiot saying this because your listeners will already know what happened, but I'm working on the basis that Biden will win. And I think that although his stated reason for digging his heels in will not arise because we will have a deal with the EU and therefore the whole question of the Irish protocol will be overtaken by the fact that there's free trade. I think there is nonetheless, long before that issue arose, there was a sense in some parts of the Democratic Party that you know, Britain mustn't be rewarded for Brexit, as they would see it, that this was a kind of affront to internationalist values, and that, you know, they got it into their heads very early on, partly just because of the coincidence in timing, that Brexit was the British Trump, right? You read that almost every day in the pages of the New York Times. The reason it's become so obsessive in its kind of anti-Britishness is because they, right from 2016, decided that Brexit and Trump were the same phenomenon. And it's not that they weighed and then dismissed the democratic or liberal or internationalist case for Brexit. It's just that they never heard it. They don't recognize that there ever was one. So I think that there is going to be a struggle. I mean, not so much with Biden himself. I mean, I think, you know, Biden is not going to be on top of the details of these things. But there may be a problem if there is a heavily democratic Congress in both houses. It will be a less comprehensive deal than it might otherwise have been. Any deal is still better than the status quo of no deal, but it will be a bit of a lost opportunity, and I think we will regret not having done something earlier.
And on another fittingly bleak note, it feels like, for a fittingly bleak podcast for the time that we're in, Chris, Dan, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to give us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to help support Spiked to keep us making this podcast and all our other podcasts, as well as our daily articles and essays, then please do consider making a donation. It's really easy to do. Just go to spiked-online.com and hit that big red donate button in the top right corner. Anything you can spare is greatly appreciated.